Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic lever it's supposed to be.
The voice of compliance on the Ethics Experts. This is like a huge day for us.
Yeah, let me get my wife in here for you to say that to her.
Bring her in. I'd love to sing your praises for a couple of minutes.
Oh, she's on a con call.
Oh, she is. We can delay this a little bit if you like.
Yes.
How you doing today?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us. You are aptly called the voice of compliance. I'm sure everyone listening to this knows who you are. You just put out so much content in this game, and it's really a tremendous amount of content. How did you get to this point of doing that?
So it evolved organically. About 4 years ago, I had the idea to create a compliance network. I went to everyone in the compliance community and no one was interested. So I just, I was an early adopter of podcasting. So I had my own podcast since 2011, and in about 2015 or 2016, I got this idea that we should have a network of compliance podcasters, one, so that everyone would have one resource or one location rather they could go to, but two, advertisers could advertise on the network and reach all of the compliance people they wanted with both products and services. Anyway, I got nowhere with that. So I basically just decided to do it on my own. And then last year I made the decision I would take the year off to see if you can make a living podcasting. The answer is no, you cannot. So, but that's really where it ramped up last year. And now I've guys like you all who, you know, see the value of being on the network.
Yeah. So last year, it kind of probably allowed you to build all the infrastructure that now other people can kind of plug into.
Right. Right.
So you have how many going right now? You have, I mean, six or something, seven? You got your daily.
So as of mine or on the network?
Yours.
Oh, 27.
Oh, wow. You have more than I'm even subscribed to. So I've been excited to get you on because you're one of the most kind of tapped into the game folks that I've heard of or listened to over the last year. We kind of see a lot of value in what you're doing. You have a good kind of penchant for, you know, staying in front of folks, bringing the most important issues kind of to the surface. Those little bite-sized morning, those morning episodes. Those I start my day with those usually, and it just sets a nice tone for the day and, you know, what's going on. So I've been excited to get you on here, and the whole point of this podcast is to help elevate ethics and compliance professionals from this check the box thing, this cost center mentality that a lot of us find ourselves trapped in. So we want to get thought leaders on here to share perspective, to share actionable tips on how we can help folks elevate and how we can turn some of those light bulbs on at the top, because I just view these functions as the most underutilized resources in most organizations that I come in contact with.
Right.
So I thought on today's episode, we can talk a little bit about your background, a little bit about what you're seeing in the market. And I'd love to make this a COVID episode. I know that's the topic du jour right now, but there's a lot of both sort of opportunities and, you know, there's a lot of opportunities right now for ethics and compliance, in my view, to step up and make that impact be seen within their organizations and be seen for the strategic levers that they can be. And you're just somebody who's a lot more plugged in than I am. And I was just going to be kind of interested to pick your brain today, you know?
Sure.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your story of how you got into this, into the compliance game?
So we are, you and I are sitting here today because of a Hummer. The Saturday after Thanksgiving, 2009, I was on a bike ride and a Hummer took me out. And, so after convalescing for 6-8 weeks, I had enough energy to get on my walker and toddle into my office at home. And I realized I was going to have to go back to work. And I decided to focus on what I had done in my last corporate position. I was general counsel of a company who had gone through, they had sustained an FCPA violation. And I came on board after everything had been resolved. And I was part of the new implementation team, or the new leadership team that came in to implement the compliance solution mandated by the Department of Justice. So that was my really first experience with compliance. And we had to design, create, and implement a compliance solution inside of a corporation with a monitor and DOJ oversight. Company got sold, my job went away, and I decided what I really wanted to do with my life was race bicycles. So I went off on this great adventure to race bicycles, and that's why I was out on a training ride when a guy with a Hummer decided to take me out. And so that's how I got, that's why you and I are here. If that guy hadn't hit me, just the same to you, I'd soon be racing bicycles. So I went in my office and I decided to focus on the nuts and bolts of compliance. At this point, there were very few lawyers in private practice doing compliance. If they did, they either did investigations or negotiated with the government. Nuts and bolts compliance work was not viewed as sexy or profitable. So, however, I was stuck at home because the only time I left my house was to go to physical therapy and I had no income. So whatever I did had to be at no cost to me. So I literally started with tweeting, LinkedIn, blogging. I started blogging. I'd always written as a lawyer. I'm a recovering trial lawyer and all that jazz. So, and then went in the in-house world. But I tell people that it was actually Twitter that put me on the compliance map. And correctly used with a focused manner, Twitter can be an incredibly powerful tool. So I started writing a little bit, and then I started posting blogs on other people's sites. Then I started, my worst injury was a double fractured left leg, but I was really banged up internally and it just took forever to heal. So I was on a walker and then crutches and then a cane. And then at about 6 months, I went to my first conference because I could finally get out of the office and out of the house. During that time, I couldn't go anywhere. Couldn't go have a drink, couldn't go have a dinner, couldn't go to a conference, couldn't go meet anyone. So I developed this worldwide compliance practice from my house, literally because I had to. And so I went to a conference, and at that point, there were three of us in the blogosphere world in compliance. And because I was not from the East Coast, specifically sort of Washington and New York and Boston, no one knew who I was. And so the universal response was, oh, you're Tom Fox. We wondered who that was. So I became known as that blogger guy. And and then I got hired on a real high profile FCPA case with Smith & Wesson. There was a huge case in 2010 called the Gunsting case. And Smith & Wesson, there were 20 plus companies involved and individuals, and Smith & Wesson was one of two public companies involved. So they had to disclose that they were under investigation. And I was not involved in the investigation or the negotiation with the government. I helped put together their compliance program. But that put me on the map because everybody in the FCPA world knew who this Smith & Wesson was in this huge case. So after that, things just sort of picked up. And late 2011, early 2012, I started podcasting, and then started writing books, and I've either evolved or devolved more into a commentator, compliance evangelist, the voice of compliance now. I wrote in 2016, I took the year off to write what I thought was the definitive compliance handbook, so a one-volume book called The Compliance Handbook, 600 pages of Tom's best practices for compliance. And then that really amped up my interest in podcasting because podcasting for me is part of the writing process. So it was all part of writing the book, and that led to trying to create a compliance podcast network in 2016, 2017. And since I was unsuccessful in persuading anyone else to join me, I just decided to do it on my own. And that led to last year, where I took the year off to see if you could make a living podcasting. Found out you couldn't. And so this year I was going back to more speaking and consulting in addition to the podcasting. So that's kind of how we got to where we are.
It's a pretty cool path. You know, as I talk to more and more people in this ethics and compliance game, nobody has a path in that's not very interesting. Like everyone's story is very interesting. It's like a winding path in. I'd love to talk a little bit about that Smith and Wesson case. What was that like going into that culture? And I mean, because you were coming in to try to impose this compliance program in a culture that didn't have that yet.
Right. So Smith and Wesson was fascinating. First of all, everyone knows who Smith and Wesson is. It doesn't matter whether you're a gun owner or not.
Yeah.
So they had huge visibility. And they took the opportunity to put in just a first class, best in class compliance program. John Rydberg was a chief compliance officer at the time and put together a fabulous program. He had full commitment from management and the company wanted to do the right thing. It was in Springfield, Massachusetts. So I got to live in Western Massachusetts for a few months in the summer. So it's always great to get out of Houston in the summer.
Yeah.
I'm in Houston. And the other interesting thing was that I had not fully appreciated. I've been around manufacturing cultures, but Smith & Wesson was not unionized and had never been unionized. In the Northeast, that's pretty unusual. But right. What they had was family members worked there forever. It was like the old steel mills in Pennsylvania, Indiana, in Illinois. And once you got a job there, you stayed there, and then your family members came there. So you had these huge extended families. And as one worker explained to me, it gave them a sense of trust and security because they're around guns. The bottom line is, and you got to feel safe around your coworkers. And if you know someone, if you knew their father, if their father knew your father, that added a sense of security that nothing untowards was going to happen, you know, what we used to call going postal. And so I'd really never had thought about that. I'd seen generations work in chemical plants along the Texas Gulf Coast, but I hadn't really considered that safety factor. So that was really interesting. That was all the hourly people. That was, you know, wasn't the white collar folks. But I thought that was really interesting. But it was a grand old company, had been around since the 1840s, had their own in-house museum, had been at their manufacturing site since 1944 in Springfield. And I learned a lot working with them.
You said a couple of things earlier. You talked about how, you know, compliance is not profitable. And then you talked about at the Smith & Wesson, they have this sort of unique culture. They didn't have these sort of shackles on them to keep people sort of adherent to the culture, right? They didn't have this union tension, but they had this sort of unspoken thing that was sort of rooted in these families that had been there for generations and so forth. And you said something else that I thought was interesting is that, you know, this guy, John Rydberg, had the full endorsement by the organization that they really wanted to put a world-class compliance program into place. So you've been in this game for a long time. That's not always the case, I don't think, or that's not always what I've seen. There's a lot of times this kind of tension because it seems like it's a cost center and, you know, I need to just kind of skirt by and do the bare minimum. What was that experience like at Smith & Wesson where you were kind of unleashed to kind of, you know, pull out all the stops, so to speak?
First of all, if I did say compliance is not profitable, that was a huge foobar. I hope I didn't say that.
No, you were saying that a lot of people viewed it as not profitable.
Okay, that's true.
Yeah.
John Rydberg was, I guess, by professional training, a internal auditor. So I'm a lawyer. So he came at things with a very different focus. So it was good and interesting for me to kind of talk lawyer ease for compliance and have him translate that into internal auditor ease. And then us jointly translated that into regular people language.
Right.
So that was really helpful and unique because of his perspective. When companies are under the gun in terms of an FCPA investigation, no pun intended, they tend to focus more on getting best practices in place. So when as a compliance officer, when you have that opportunity, you have to grab it and you have to run with it.
So do you feel like the culture of the company helped open those lanes for you guys to run? Or do you feel like the strong force was really this FCPA sort of reaction that you guys were sort of taking advantage of in order to put these right, you know, pillars in place?
That's hard to say because I don't know what the culture was before I got there, but management, when I got there, was fully committed to putting a best practice compliance program in place. So that they were fully on board at that point.
So going back to what you were talking about, you know, a lot of people viewing compliance as not profitable, as this sort of gotta have cost center type of thing. Why do you think it's so hard for people to see it the way you and I do?
Sure. It's because the way compliance evolved. So the modern era of FCPA enforcement started around 2004. There are a variety of theories as to why that began. One theory is it's an outgrowth of 9/11. And the Bush administration was looking for security laws they could enforce. And they viewed corruption as leading to terrorism, loose borders, and those sorts of things. Another is Sarbanes-Oxley came into effect in early 2002. And Sarbanes-Oxley required companies to certify whether their controls were effective or not. And if they were not, that's an FCPA violation. The other thing is the oil for food scandal, where the back when Saddam Hussein was still in control of Iraq, there were huge violations by U.S. companies of in that program, and those were all FCPA violations. So you had a moral authority, which really drove some statutory enforcement. And there are probably some other reasons that I haven't articulated as well. But whatever the reason or reasons, we had this explosion of growth. And starting around 2004, the FCPA came into effect in 1977 and had not been enforced as rigorously. So the first response was, when you have a regulation or a law enforced, is to for legal to come in and do something and to get companies to comply with the law, hence compliance. The problem was it was written by lawyers for lawyers and very legalistic approach, thou shalt don'ts and thou shalt nots, that sort of thing. So that is what, and compliance became the land of no, populated by Dr. No, because they were telling people, no, you couldn't do business this way, even if you'd done business that way in the past. So that's sort of the first thing. The first wave of compliance was really this legal focused policies and procedures written by lawyers for lawyers with zero input from the business, zero concern about how it impacted business. So it was viewed as something that slowed business down. The Department of Justice and Securities and Exchange Commission, the two agencies which enforce the FCPA, evolved in their thinking sort of starting, I would say, in 2010 or so, to understanding that properly seeing compliance as a business process. So when you start to make that change, and the reason their evolution was so important is that as the regulators, they drive what companies do, what companies' reactions are. And as they talked about compliance in conferences, symposia, they released a couple of documents, several documents actually, talking about what a best practices compliance program is, you could begin to see it was more of a business process. When it becomes a business process, then you can measure it. And if you measure it, then you can improve it and you can continuously improve it. And you begin to see improvements in the business process. I think where we are now in compliance is that effective compliance equates to more efficient business process, which at the end of the day leads to greater ROI and corporate profitability.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think, well, that history lesson is extremely interesting. And the fact that it kind of came in as a, like you called it, the Dr. No, or it kind of came in at odds with the business and it was sort of being imposed on the business, sort of tainted it from a business person's perspective, I think, for a while. And I think you're exactly right. There's always going to be sort of a step away or a step removed from the ROI, you know, the process to the ROI. But I kind of liken it, you know, you came from a manufacturing background or have been around those types of businesses. I kind of equate it. I kind of equate it to like the safety thing. So safety doesn't make any money, but it helps you from losing money. And the companies that have the highest, the actually best safety programs, they always run better. They always make more money than their counterparts. It's a more well-oiled machine, you know, pardon the pun. And I think you're right. I think as we start to look at it as a business process, and it's something that's manageable, and it's something that can create some of that goodness that will generate that ROI, we're starting to see some of those light bulbs at the top go on.
It's interesting you bring up the safety analogy. When I was a trial lawyer, I represented corporations in catastrophic personal injury, property damage, and business disputes. And in the late 80s, I've always practiced in Houston. In the late 80s, we had a couple of just horrific, and I mean horrific, plant explosions with multiple loss of life, millions of dollars of damages. Then we also had the Exxon Valdez. And the energy companies and plant manufacturers recognized that the costs were catastrophic. Not simply the cost of repair and the cost of human life, but the cost of lawsuits, the cost of regulation, the cost of fines. And so starting in the late 80s, there was a sea change in the attitude around safety in energy companies. And literally every time I would go into a plant, I would have to have a safety briefing. Every meeting in the energy industry, even if it's the general counsel's office, starts off with a safety moment. And there was a huge change in that culture, and they drove down the cost because they made safety absolute number one, and they made the business of operating energy companies much more safe. Compliance is about 15 years behind that. So I've seen that process go through. But the thing that excites me about compliance in 2020 and going forward is that I see compliance having the opportunity to take a step past safety, because they can actually improve business process performance, and that can not simply save money. I don't mean to suggest that. I think the step is we're going to actually make companies money, and we're going to make them more profitable because they're going to be more efficient, not simply the saving of money from regulatory fines, lawsuits, or others.
Tell me some more about that, because I think as I've thought about it, I've kind of just limited it to sort of a corollary to the safety thing, where it's like, hey, you know, if we can embed this in our culture, hey, if safety's the real deal, the board meetings are starting with a safety discussion, to your point. And those are kind of safety nets, you know, again, pardon the pun, to prevent us from tripping up and having to pay, you know, lawsuits and fines and stuff like that. Tell me some more about how you think it can start actually making money.
Let's take your world, hotline reporting. In December 2018, a George Washington University professor produced a paper where he looked at hotline data, anonymized hotline data, and from one company, not your company. And that led him to the following stunning number, that companies with not simply a hotline, but a culture of reporting had a material a 5% less cost in litigation, fines, penalties, et cetera. So there's a material difference. Now, it's not just a hotline. And I know you guys, at your organization, you work on culture all the time. So if you think about a hotline as a part of a reporting culture, part of it is you have a hotline, but part of it is somebody's there to answer it. Somebody like me is there to triage it. If there's a need for an investigation, there's an investigation protocol. The investigation's done. The reporter, the hotline reporter, is communicated with, and the investigation moved forward. If it turns out that there is a violation of something, whether it be a policy, procedure, or a legal violation, there's a remediation. It's fixed. But it doesn't stop there. If you create that sort of culture where people are willing to raise their hand and speak up, they're going to raise their hand and speak up to improve business process. They're going to raise their hand and speak up to improve your company's performance. And that's the culture of reporting that struck me about that article. It's a hotline is one part of it, but it's that entire culture. And if you can have that culture, which costs you nothing to have because you have to have a hotline anyway, by law. And if you institute all of the things around to make your hotline work, then you can move to a culture of reporting. And compliance can lead that because compliance has to be there. And compliance cuts through all of the different corporate functions that would touch or a hotline report would touch. So having that, not simply a hotline in place, but an entire culture of reporting. And I mean, I watch your videos on what you guys do around culture. So I know you're committed to that. If you would take that same sort of diagnostic that you guys are using and move that out to a broader corporation, that would be an improvement that would improve profitability and not simply save money.
So I love that angle. To your point, compliance really wraps around the whole company. It touches all these different areas. It's not like to break the analogy with safety. Safety is just sort of relegated to the plant, right? It's not, you know, no one's worried about safety in the break room at corporate headquarters other than the extent to which it's part of sort of culture and, you know, you're starting meetings with it. But that compliance piece is going to wrap around everything. And by sort of leaning into that law and that requirement and leaning into the cultural implications of it and generating a culture, to your point, where people feel like, hey, I need to speak up about this thing that's not right, it can, I think, engender a feeling of ownership for the organization and caring for the organization. And that is going to empower people. That speak up culture can extend beyond, hey, I see something that's not right on someone's behavior. I see something that's not right in this business process. And that continuous improvement lifeblood that every organization wants pumping through its veins can actually start to take hold. It's a really powerful angle.
So another example I use is there was a company who wanted to look, they wanted to do as a traditional fraud risk analysis as you could do, which was to look at gift, travel, and entertainment spend by their business development personnel in one country. That country happened to be a FCPA high-risk country. So there was a compliance angle. They looked at the spend, and what they found was that the spend broke down into two fairly distinct poles on the axis, a low and a high, which they called an A and a Z. You had to spend A to make a sale. But the more interesting one point was point Z, because at point Z, if you got to that point, it became clear the customer was not going to sign a contract with you. They were not going to buy your products or services. So the point A was the low point. You had to spend some money for business development, you know, client development, getting to know the client, or maybe just buttering up the client. Whatever the reason was, they wanted A spent on them. But Z was above that, you were not going to make a sale. And so the company decreed to this business unit, you had to spend A, but you couldn't spend more than Z. And they were concerned that the salesman would go in revolt. These were commission-based salesmen. Turned out the salesman loved it. They loved it because that Z point gave them a metric by which they understood this client or potential client had was a very little chance they were going to sign a contract. And if they didn't sign a contract, I didn't get paid. So they just went to the next client. And so it decreased the sales cycle in that business unit and made that business unit more profitable. And that was a compliance analysis because they were looking at things like, because it was high risk FCPA, it was a low, relatively low spending limit, $75. So how many receipts were at $74.99? How many were split receipts? I mean, as basic analysis you can make of spending, that led to all of the insights that I just articulated.
So, I mean, that's just a great example of how this sort of one goal, this compliance goal, could end up rippling out and changing the behaviors in, you know, boots on the ground, people in the foxhole, so to speak, that are going to lead toward that higher efficiency, higher profitability, higher ROI, the things that the people at the top actually care about. That's a great example. And it provided a lot of...
I call that the ethical edge.
The ethical edge. Well, yes. That study, you know, just came out recently. It comes out every year about the most ethical companies. And, you know, I think in this last study, it was like over 13% outperformance to their counterparts. And I would argue that it's probably higher on the private side. You know, that was just looking at public companies. I would argue it's even higher on the public side. And I would argue it's probably even higher as you go down, down market in company size, because there's so much more sort of inefficiencies as you go down to smaller companies and stuff like that, where that ethical edge can really, really create a differential in their operations. I'd love to kind of pivot toward this COVID thing, because, you know, from what I'm seeing, a lot of our folks are, they're in reactionary mode. And I think that there's like a big opportunity here. As you look out over the next, I don't know, how long is this going to go? 18 months, 2 months, you know, nobody really knows. What are you seeing in the compliance and ethics space in terms of like their near-term challenges? What are you seeing in terms of near and medium term opportunities for people to magnify their impact?
So I think you're right in terms of right now, people are in that reactionary mode. So I decided my role in this was to, of course, start a podcast. So I started Compliance and Coronavirus to try to bring as much information about the business implications and compliance implications of coronavirus to the marketplace. And one of the podcasts, a woman talked about time horizons. And for the first time, you may need to focus on a 24-hour time horizon. So because your compliance team is working remotely, you may need to check in with them as a group every day and find out, what are you doing today, as in the next 24 hours? Then she said, and think a week out then. When was the last time you thought about a timeline of 1 week? Not very often. So that the time horizons may be compressed. I talked to a couple of business guys, entrepreneur types, and they were most insistent about questions around liquidity. So, of course, everyone's thinking about that. And their thoughts were 60 days. How are you going to survive for 60 days? That's all you have to focus on right now. Does that mean you might put some bills off? You might put off a capital expenditure. You might, you know, have to put off any raises or bonuses, whatever you have to do to get through the next 60 days. You might want to extend that out to 90, but I really like that focus on, okay, what do I have to do? What's the minimum I can do to get by? So first of all is time horizons, thinking about time in a way that perhaps businesses had not in the past, or in addition to, you know, 1, 3, 5 years, whatever it might be. The second thing is that how are you going to continue to communicate the message of compliance to a now not a disparate workforce, but one that is dispersed? You know, if you're working from home, how are you going to keep those messages out? How are you going to make sure that the additional pressures people feel, whether that be to make numbers, whether that be to, you know, hit their quotas, am I going to have a job in 30 days, so I better make a sale? All of those pressures. How are you going to keep up the compliance message so that they don't make a misstep, they don't make a mistake? And you've got to keep those up. You've got to keep your employee trust up. I mean, and that's, you know, you guys talk about that within your company, but you also talk about that, I think, a lot to your customer base and your client base, that you have to give people trust that you're going to do the right thing for them going forward, and that the human capital is the most important capital that you have right now. So that's sort of the reactionary mode. The question you raised is funny. I just got off the phone for our podcast recording my 84-year-old uncle, and that was the question he said. So what opportunities are there? And that's not only a great question, but it's what I'm focusing on sort of going forward. Is the originally I thought, well, you know, the end of April, maybe the end of May, we'll just turn the switch on and start up again. Well, that's not going to happen. Everything's going to change. So I'm in Houston. The energy economy is in the tank. We're in a complete economic dislocation that may be, you know, the worst one since the Great Depression. And how are we going to weather that? And then how are we going to do business? If my business in large part was getting on a plane and going speaking somewhere, that may not ever come back, or it may come back slowly. And a lot of people, you know, I'm going to put out my hand and shake here, because that's how we did business. You know, you met somebody and you developed a personal relationship with them, and then you developed a business relationship with them. But that personal contact is many people find that absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. So how are you going to make sales? How are you going to be able to communicate what you have for the marketplace? And then how are you going to deliver that? I've been working remotely now since 2010. So that to me seems second nature, but I've always worked for myself and my scale is me. I am the Compliance Podcast Network. So how can you take the not only enthusiasm, but the skills and motivation I have, and how do you scale that up to an organization so you can deliver, you know, hundreds and thousands of those sorts of services? And those are going to be critical questions that we're all going to have to figure out. I was on another podcast this morning, and they were talking about doing Passover Seders with their families across the globe. And somebody said, well, my grandmother learned how to do FaceTime. She did FaceTime for the first time. So it's going to be a huge change, but it's going to be a change that people like you and I are going to have to think about, because we're going to have to deliver services to our customers in a completely different way.
And I think what you've done over the last few years in terms of establishing yourself as this sort of point of credibility and establishing this voice and all of this output, this may actually be a nice tailwind for you as we emerge from this, as people begin to see that, hey, I don't have to go to this conference. I don't have to sort of meet this person face to face. They're going to get more comfortable with these types of interactions that I think this thing is forcing us to have. You know, I'm kind of a face-to-face type of a person. I've always liked to kind of meet somebody face-to-face and so forth. But I think I've seen over the last couple of weeks, as I've had more of these types of interactions, I've really gotten to have a lot of the same benefit from that face-to-face thing over a screen. And, you know, our family gets together and does those kind of, you know, group FaceTime, those house party, you know, app and stuff like that. It's always painful when we rip off the Band-Aid. But as we start to get used to this new world, it could create a lot of opportunities for folks like you who have established that kind of credibility from, you know, you've been putting those roots in the ground for a long time.
So yesterday I interviewed a fellow from a nonprofit in the compliance space, and his company on May 1 is going to roll out a compliance certification, but the training or the classes for the certification are all remote. And going to be available for download and review at your own home. Every other certification in the compliance space requires in-person training. Now, they developed this training, started about 6 months ago, so it's far beyond thinking about COVID-19.
Right.
But it struck me that that's going to be the new wave of training for a certification.
Right.
Is that, and because they're rolling out first, whether it's happy luck or, you know, whatever the reason, timing wise, they are going to have the lead on everybody else trying to catch up, because the other compliance certification or certifications in the compliance space, those companies are trying to figure out how to move their 2-day seminars to an online. And I don't know if you've ever sat through 2 days in front of a computer for an online class, but it is brutal. Those types of things you're going to have to think about.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess when you go to those conferences, you at least get those little breaks in between. You're getting up and you're walking around, and the extroverts get to burn off a little bit of their extrovert energy and get recharged. You're not just sitting in a room with the fan going, with the scenery not changing for, you know, 2 days straight.
Let me go to the hotline, because there's an opportunity for hotline companies in this current environment that I had not fully appreciated until I was recording yet another podcast where we were talking about interviews. And the question was posed is, how do you determine the truthfulness, the sincerity, all of the clues that you would, you know, use when you're talking to somebody about the truth of the matter they're talking to you about? And if you and I were in a room, you'd be observing my body language. I was taught to focus on the body. Mm-hmm. You know, and you could get clues from that, but you can't generally in a Zoom call or a FaceTime or other. But what you can do is, and this is a great example, I know our listeners can't see this, but we are on a video podcast or a video Zoom call, and we are much closer than you and I would be if we were sitting across the table at an interview.
Good point.
Or if you were doing an intake, or you were sitting, I had been the reporter and you were the company representative sitting down with me. And I can see your eyes in a way that I could not if I was sitting across the table, because the glasses I have to wear right don't let me see three feet across. And so by focusing on your eyes, I'm getting a lot more clues than I would if I was watching your body. So that if you could teach or at least communicate that to your clients on, here's some ways to pick up those body language clues that we all talk about, but in a different way. And it's because the video camera that we are both looking into is, in my case, it's, I guess, about 12 inches away from me. And you're much closer. So I can see a part of you I typically would not see. Now, I can't see you tapping your feet or, you know, if your hands are bouncing off the bottom of the table, but I can see your eyes. And that's something, that's a clue I had not ever tuned into before.
Yeah, that's a really interesting angle. There's something to that. I mean, again, as we acclimate to this new world, there's different sort of opportunities and threats that pop up, right? It's a new frontier that we're on. And as we get used to this new lay of the land, we not only have to adjust for these sort of negatives, these negative externalities, we also need to keep our eyes open for those positive externalities. And I think you just touched on a big one. How do you think guys could start incorporating that better? Just being trained up more on sort of body language and how eyes move and things like that?
Well, I think it's just look at somebody's eyes. I mean, like I said, I was trained as a young lawyer, focus on the body. You know, what are their hands doing? Are their feet tapping? Are they bouncing around the chair? That sort of thing. And I think that if you just do it for a little bit, you'll be able to determine, you know, somebody looks away or looks down or, you know, does their eyes in a certain way at the critical question or leading up to the series of critical questions that may influence what your opinion of their statements are.
That's so interesting. And there's also a piece of the Zoom meeting, because like only right now am I staring right at the camera, which is what it would be like if we were looking into each other's eyes, but we're actually looking at different, our eyes are actually like looking sort of past each other on these Zoom meetings, which gives you a different perspective and gives you sort of a different angle to look at the person and just zoom in on the person, no pun intended. I like that. I got to think on that. There's a lot in there on that. Let me ask you this. When we're talking about employee trust and we're talking about employer branding, right? We're talking about the reputation of an organization to somebody who's coming in the organization and how that sort of corresponds with the reputation that the organization tries to put out into the marketplace. In the context of COVID-19, where do you think you're going to start to see some things fall away?
So I'm going to write this down because you actually said three separate things there. Okay, trust. Trust, that's the emotional connection I have of whether, I hate to use the same word to define a word, but trust you. Reputation. That's what people think about me. Branding. I think branding is the following. Branding is not your reputation. Branding is not your trust. Branding is your relationship. What is your, as in your relationship with your clients? I don't think it is simply that we're a company that delivers this cost-effective service. It's this company that is there for them at all times. And I learned that, I always thought it was your reputation. And my wife got me a online masterclass series of authors, directors, artist types.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I did all the writers first. And both David Baldacci and James Patterson said, your brand is not your reputation. Your brand is your relationship with your readers.
Wow.
And so I started thinking about that. And if you think about your brand as your relationship, it's what are people expecting you to deliver? Now, it doesn't mean you can't change. But it, in James Patterson's case, he said, if I'm going to write a teenage love novel, I need to tell people this is a teenage love novel. Because it's, if you pick up a James Patterson book, you're expecting a thriller.
Right.
So it's not fair to write that and not tell someone, because you will damage that relationship. And so what's the relationship of Compliance Line with its customer base? And so I've really come around to thinking that that is as important as the reputation and trust. By delivering something that there's an expectation of what you're going to deliver, and that you fulfill that expectation. And if that expectation is not going to be met, you have a conversation around, this is what I'm going to do differently, so that you're prepared for it.
That's kind of a mind blowing thing. I thought I kind of understood branding, and I think I would have described it, and I've always been describing it on other episodes and to everybody else I've talked to, as your reputation. And I think when you talk about it as a relationship, it's sort of it adds a dimension to it. You know what I'm saying?
No, I absolutely get it, because I was the same way. And when James Patterson said that, I just went, wow. I mean, that right. was really an aha moment for me.
How was that? Those courses, were those pretty cool?
Incredibly cool. I mean, Doris Goodwin on presidential leadership. I just finished Bob Iger, former CEO of Disney right now. I'm on Ron Howard on directing. I'm just trying to
see those ads, and they look so interesting.
Yeah. $200 for, I think, 30 courses.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I'll have to check that out, but man, that is, yeah. Cause your relationship is an extension of your reputation. You have a relationship with somebody. I mean, your reputation is maybe kind of part of it, but adding that other angle to it, I think adds some more gravity to the whole thing.
Exactly.
So in the COVID situation, right, as you see, you know, there's always kind of, as stress goes up, you've seen all the studies, right? As stress goes up, or as your willpower drops, that happens on sort of a micro level. And so on an organizational level, as the stress levels go up, you're going to see all these little sort of pockets of stress, and those open up opportunities for compromise, right? Whether those are on a individual basis or on a company-wide basis to cut a corner or, you know, skimp on something. What concerns, like, do you have as we look, you know, let's say that this does kick off into sort of an extended recession? What sort of things do you think will start falling first from a compliance standpoint? You know what I'm saying? What dominoes will start getting knocked over first?
So if you think of compliance as Dr. No from the land of no and a cost center, it's going to be viewed as a nice to have, not a must have. That's why compliance professionals need to develop the branding, i.e. the relationship, that we are here to facilitate business operations. And we do that by making the business process run more smoothly. Now, yes, there's some things you have to do, but you can also, if you're there as a compliance officer making things run more smoothly and more efficiently, that's going to give you greater credibility and allow people to talk to you and come to you.
And so maybe, you know, those folks who haven't done that work to build those relationships and build that sort of internal branding, they now have to try to create it now.
Yep.
So what would you tell someone, just to wrap up, I want to be conscious of your time, but what would you tell somebody who's just kind of getting into this game, maybe, you know, or somebody who's in one of these sort of cost center type businesses, or who view them as a kind of a cost center? What would you tell them in this, you know, in the next week or the next month that they should do to really elevate and break out and show what their worth is? And is there hope for them to do that?
So yes, there is hope. The first thing is communicate. If you are working at home and you're a compliance officer, you start calling other people in different corporate disciplines. And if you don't have a relationship with them and you can't go down and have a cup of coffee with them, you develop a relationship, either a Zoom call or a phone call. And you make clear that you're there to help them, and that you are concerned about not only their well-being, but their department's well-being. Two is, you need to not sweat the small stuff. The flip side of that is, you need to understand what the big stuff is. So what's the biggest risk to your organization? In my world, that's called the FCPA, and that means international sales. That means you don't have to worry about domestic sales. You do have to worry about international sales. More importantly, are you doing any business in high-risk areas? So focus on that. How are you compensating people? Do you utilize third-party sales agents, which are typically viewed as the highest risk, or do you use your own sales team? Depending on the answer, that's going to be your highest risk. So focus on your highest risk. And then the third thing would be to look at technological solutions that can make compliance more efficient. The first place to look, though, is inside your corporation. I happen to have a wife who's an SAP guru, so I know a lot more about ERP systems than the average lawyer. But there are a lot of different tools that every corporation has that compliance and legal don't know about. SAP has functions which allow you to determine commission rates. They allow you to determine spending rates. Compliance officers don't know anything about that. Well, now's the time to see what you have that you can start running analyses and running reports to see if there is a problem, and if there is inefficiency, how can you help the company become more efficient? So technological solutions to typically lawyer-responded compliance program problems right now could be a great resource for you. You don't have to spend money. You can look internal to your corporation and see what exists. But that comes from having a relationship with the finance, with the CFO, with internal audit, with internal controls. Find out what they have and what you can use from the compliance perspective.
Yeah, and the best time to build that relationship is 10 years ago, and the second best time is today. So start doing it now. Start reaching out and seeing what you can do to help. Start seeing what you can do to magnify your impact. And, you know, it's our time to kind of step up into the mantle of leadership and make our voices heard and make our impact felt.
Right. So, and I mean, if we want to tie it down to hotlines, where are your hotspots? Have you looked at that in depth? If you want to take the flip side, where are we not getting reports from? What does that tell us? Do we need to go talk to some people? All of those things that you can garner, and that's information every company has because they have to have it, because they have to have a hotline. They've got those reports somewhere. And if you don't have information, what does that tell you? That tells you that's another problem.
Yeah. And to your point, it's like this little gold mine of information that you can infer so much from and do so much, you can really magnify the impact just from looking at what's going on, both on the positive and negative side. Where are things happening? Great, let's go attack them. Hey, this is too quiet. You know, like something's like a little bit too quiet. That's also a signal. So, Tom, I just appreciate your time. I appreciate you coming on here. This has been a phenomenal episode for us. I appreciate what you do for this industry. You're really leading from the front and setting a great example for the rest of us and pushing out so much great content and knowledge work. I just appreciate your friendship. I appreciate you coming on and just wish you all the best.
Well, thanks.